If you like Area 45, you're going to enjoy the Hoover Institution's other podcasts, Uncommon Knowledge, The Classicist with Victor Davis Hanson, and The Libertarian with Richard Epstein. Subscribe now to the Hoover Podcast at hoover.org/podcasts. That's hoover.org/podcasts. Hoover Podcast, ideas defining a free society. Hello, it's Friday, November the 16th, and welcome to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast examining the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. I'm Bill Whalen, the Hoover Institution's Virginia Hobbs Carpenter Fellow in Journalism. Joining me today in studio here on the campus of Stanford University is Dr. Abbas Milani. He is a Hoover Research Fellow, the Hamid and Christina Mogadam Director of Iranian Studies at Stanford University, and a professor by courtesy in the Division of Stanford Global Studies. He has written numerous books on Iran, Persia, and his earlier days as a native of that land. Dr. Milani is also the 2017 recipient of the Richard W. Lyman Award, which is given annually to a Stanford faculty member in recognition of his or her outstanding service to the university's alumni. Abbas, it's great to have you back on the podcast.
It's my pleasure, as usual.
First, how are you feeling? You told me that you had a little procedure.
I had a little procedure, and I feel very fine. The miracles of modern medicine never cease to surprise me and pleasantly surprise me.
It is a reminder we live in a wonderful age in terms of medicine. You can go in and get things done, and it's not as invasive as it used to be, and you're not spending 3 weeks in the hospital. And you know.
As a friend of mine was saying that if you think back, Mozart died at 35. Mm-hmm. If they had modern medicine, he might have lived another 40 years and created remarkable works. Beethoven at 50. If they both live now, their life expectancy would be probably 90.
Exactly. So we are approaching the end of 2018, and there is a dubious anniversary of sorts coming on December the 28th, and that is the one-year anniversary of the protests that began in Tehran and Mashhad. You and I last did a podcast in January, I believe, and at this time there were protests going on. There were protests again in Iran in August, chants of death to the dictator. There were protests in November in reaction to U.S. sanctions, which we're going to talk about in a moment. Here we are sitting in smoke-filled California, and you hear this phrase being talked about, the new in California, or wildfires, the new are going to be forever encompassed in smoke. My question, Abbas Milani, are protests the new in Iran?
Well, they're not the new. They have been off and on for the last, I think, 39 years. I mean, the Islamic Republic, in spite of its stability, has been rather remarkably unstable because they have faced challenges. Mm-hmm. And right now, as we speak, there is a virtual national strike by teachers. There is a serious semi-national strike by truck drivers. There is a several thousand strong strike in Haftapeh, one of the bigger industrial concerns in the southern part of Iran. So there hasn't been any shortage of strikes and demonstrations, but the news is so grim in the economic domain, and the regional news has been so grim because of Yemen and because of what has been happening in Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. that some of the Iranian news has not gotten the coverage that I think it deserves.
You anticipated my next question. Trump does impose sanctions, I think, on November the 5th, I want to say, early November. But we have not had much of a conversation in this country about Iran. We've been looking at Yemen, and we've been looking at Saudi Arabia and the killing of Mr. Khashoggi. Iran seems to be off the radar screen right now.
Well, I think Iran was the inadvertent, unintended recipient of some positive consequence because of the Khashoggi event, mm-hmm. because the Khashoggi event brought attention to the brutalities of Saudi Arabia, mm-hmm. and the Khashoggi event made the media look more critically at what is happening in Yemen, and Iran, under the radar of all of these things, continued its brutality. They have executed several people in the last week, mm-hmm. Two people 3 days ago on charges of economic corruption. And from all I can understand, the only charge they could really make stick is that these people bought coins.
This was currency trading, right?
It was currency trading. Right. It was essentially coin. And they bought coin cheap, hoping, mm-hmm. calculating that it will become more expensive. And that's all they've done. The real corruptors of the economy, which is the IRGC, for example, which are the children of the clergy, for example, which are some of the clergy themselves, they are going scot-free.
I saw that one other thing that Iranian officials are cracking down on is cosmetic surgery, rhinoplasties in particular. There's a new law that now requires you to go before a judge in Iran if you want to have a rhinoplasty, if you want to have a nose job.
Well, Iran, I think last year had per capita the highest number of plastic surgery. Plastic surgery has become an epidemic in Iran.
Why so?
Well, because of attempts to fix their nose, their attempts to for men to fix their faces. There is a level of frivolity, I think, that some of the rich can attend to.
Right.
And it's become a fashion. It's become something of a fashion. There is an article that actually says that some of the people who can't afford a nose job actually put Band-Aids on their noses to appear as if they have had a nose job. So that is, for me, a grim fact. But, you know, you have to realize that Iran under this regime is a dour country, and people need to make their own joys. They need to make private heterotopias.
Right.
They need to have private parties. There is an underground life filled with joy, filled with some frivolities, that is completely incommensurate with this dire false piety that the regime has built as its persona.
Let's talk about what drives the underground around, the one that is trying to find frivolity, as you said. So here in the United States of America, it's very simple. If you want to engage in frivolity, what do? You have social media. You have Facebook, you have Instagram, you have entire TV channels engaged in celebrity worship. You have just scads of ways to engage in distractions, if you will. But how does this work in a society that is cloistered, where the government does not want a sharing of social media? How do people get together and have fun?
Well, again, not everything that they do on the social media is frivolity.
Right.
Some of it is very much organizing. Some of
yes.
it is fact-gathering. Some of it is exposing the regime.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do in order to fight the dour reality is go to social media. Iran is one of the most active in terms of social media. Although Facebook is banned, it has maybe 40 million users. Twitter is banned. It has more than a million users in Iran. Instagram has up to 40 million users. There are Iranian personalities that each have 4-5 million followers. So there is an enormous subculture.
Is this a function of Iranians finding a way to get around the government office, or is just the government, there's so many people, the government just can't chase everybody around the block?
Both of those.
Both.
The government can chase them.
Mm-hmm.
They find all kinds of ways to get around the regime's very draconian censorship right now. Mm-hmm. There's a recent study by Freedom House that says Iran, after China and before Syria, are the three most censored internets in the world. But Iran is also one of the most active, one of the most vibrant. People are extremely clever at subverting the regime's effort to create a wall, very much in the Chinese model.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very much in cahoots with China in trying to learn from China how to censor. But people have so far stayed ahead. And they also, aside from social media, there's an underground theater scene, there's an underground cinemas, there are underground raves, parties. There is an enormous amount of efforts for men and women to meet one another outside the norms that the regime likes to allow, which is only within marriage or if it's to be an... So it's a vibrant society that lives and pulsates under this veneer of Islamic Republic, which has a reality because the regime then engages in shenanigans in the region. The regime then shoots its own citizens on charges of corruption.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that it's a happy society, but I'm saying there are two societies. There is a regime reality, and there is a people reality that is trying to fight at every effort, led by women.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the sanctions and the economic consequences, and then the political and consequences, diplomatic consequences. So what the Trump administration has done is it's reimposed the sanctions that would have been lifted under the 2015 nuclear accord. The sanctions ban transactions with Iran involving U.S. dollar banknotes, gold, precious metals, aluminum, steel, commercial passenger aircraft, and coal. They end imports into the U.S. of Iranian carpets and foodstuffs. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Abbas, but this is a gamble. So it's a gamble on several fronts. First of all, it's a gamble that European nations won't violate sanctions and risk getting cut off from U.S. markets. It's a gamble that Iran won't go back to enrichment, Iranian enrichment, and try to build a bomb. But it's also a gamble, ultimately, that what? The government's going to cave. You impose more economic hardship on the government, and eventually it collapses of its own weight. So your thoughts on the sanctions, and tell me what your instinct is on where this is going to go.
I think on all those three accounts, that is the gamble that they're making.
Mm-hmm.
I think the gamble that the regime will collapse, or that the regime under pressure will come and make a new deal, is much less than much less likely to happen. The thing that is often not talked about, and to me is a major potential strategically important consequence, is that the regime will attempt to engage more with China and Russia and become more dependent on Russia and China in order to solve this problem. This issue is openly talked about in Iran.
When you say engage, you mean trade?
Trade, make concessions to Russia, mm-hmm. make Iranian bases, military bases available to Russia,
mm-hmm.
Repivot Iran away from the West, essentially, mm-hmm. towards East. Khamenei has given a few talks in the last 2-3 months, mm-hmm. literally talking about this.
Right.
I'm sure you remember when this regime came to power, its slogan was neither East nor West.
Mm-hmm.
That we don't want to be dependent on Soviet Union nor on the U.S. Now, Khamenei literally says that neither East side need no longer be part of our strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Our future is much more inclined towards the Chinese and the Russians and the Indians. And that would be a very important repivot. And I think you're absolutely right that the jury is still out on to what extent Europeans are going to abide by the UN secondary sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
They're clearly trying to find ways to allow companies to subvert this. Whether companies will take the chance, it's not very clear. I think the U.S. market is so
right.
appealing that many Europeans.
Which nations are we talking? France and Germany?
France, Germany, Italy, the EU is openly talking about setting up funds that would support,
mm-hmm.
setting up mechanisms that would allow non-US dollar-based barter.
Mm-hmm.
One other strategic consequence potential for all of this, and Russia is very active in this, China is very active in this, Europeans are beginning to become more active in this, and that is the notion of moving trade away from a dollar-based trade to other currencies.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been one of the foundations of U.S. economic power and hegemony since Bretton Woods 1944.
Mm-hmm.
And if that shifts, again, it has consequences for the United States, for Europe, and certainly for Iran. The idea that if you pressure this regime, it's going to change its behavior in the region, for example,
mm-hmm.
realities don't support that.
All right, let's talk about the reaction within Iran after the sanctions are imposed. So there are protests, and protests against the United States, correct?
There have been some protests against the United States.
Mm-hmm.
To what extent those were orchestrated by the regime, to
right.
what extent they reflect the real sentiments of the people is very hard to
right.
say. My sense, I don't have empirical data to back it, but it's mm-hmm. anecdotal evidence. My sense is that people are blaming at least as much the regime
mm-hmm.
as they are the Trump administration.
What exactly is the hardship? How is the economy hit by this?
Well, since we last talked, the currency went from 3,000, I think 400 was when we were last talking,
mm-hmm.
to that is 3,400 Iranian tuman for $1. It is now at almost 15,000 to $1.
Wow.
And essentially, in order to get a sense of what that means in Iran, if you didn't have your value, your worth in dollar or in gold, you've lost 2/3 of it. Furthermore, in reality, people get paid in riyal,
right,
but actually buy in dollar because everything is, that is imported. And everyone who has a commodity anticipating this rise or watching this rise has now increased the prices of a household. Inflation is going to be probably 60% this year, and the actual number might be even higher. This is the official number. So that has changed and impacted lives. Although officially medicine is not part of the sanctions, in reality, companies have been reluctant to sell to Iran or buy open letters of credit. So some medicine has been difficult to buy in Iran. So the people of Iran are getting punished. And part of my difficulty with the sanctions is that it is punishing the very people who are as much the victims of this regime as anyone else in the region is. And if anything is going to change this regime, and I have no doubt that that will happen, it's the people of Iran. And to punish them at this time is a gamble that I'm not sure is going to pay off.
This is the conundrum. On the one hand, let's say, yes, let's impose sanctions, put more pressure, and hope that that's the tipping point. On the other hand, let's say let's do nothing, let the protests continue, and again, it collapses of its own weight. That requires a lot of patience. And as we've seen in the last year, the regime can withstand protests.
The regime can stand protests, but as we have also seen historically, the regime increased, for example, its nuclear program from about 3,000 centrifuges to 19,000 at the height of these sanctions. The regime increased its shenanigans in Syria at the time where the sanctions were the most biting, international sanctions, UN sanctions. So this is not a regime that easily sees the reality on the ground and says, okay, let's stop spending billions in Syria and attend to the problems at home. So to me, the middle of that conundrum, that kind of binary, you don't do anything and wait for them to collapse, or you put enough pressure on them that the people will rise up and end the regime, is a false binary. There is an alternative middle road, and that is put a lot of pressure on the regime, freeze their assets, make their travel outside Iran difficult. The United States, Europe, must have informed data about where these people have parked their money. Freeze those, go after those. The best way to get to a cleric, this is an old adage in Persian language, is to hit him at the pocket. And these people are now some of the most corrupt business empire builders within Iran. Go after their assets. Make their life difficult. Then you might hear them change their tune.
If you are the United States government, how do you communicate to the people of Iran that we are doing this for your own good, in essence? That we, yes, we understand we're imposing hardship, but there's a good goal here in that we are doing this for your freedom.
Well, first of all, one of the things I wouldn't do, and the Trump administration has repeatedly, not directly, but because of some of its important figures, has done this, is to send the wrong message to Iran. The message being that we, the United States, are going to decide who the next alternative in Iran is. When Mr. Giuliani, for example, though he doesn't have an official position in the Trump administration, but everybody understands he's the lawyer of the President of the United States. When he goes to a convention of a group that is not particularly popular in Iran, the MEK, and talks about, or Mr. Bolton talks about them as the alternative, that sends the wrong message to Iran. That sends the message that we are going to, the United States is going to pick the next regime in Iran. that hasn't done well in the past for the United States. Mm-hmm. It's not doing any good now. The United States should clearly, categorically say the fate of Iran is in the hands of the Iranians. Mm-hmm. The Iranians in diaspora are as much part of Iran as the Iranians inside. I don't say that the diaspora should have no role in it, and the United States shouldn't be in discussions with them. But say categorically, the future of Iran is in the hands of the Iranian people, and we're going to make every effort possible to make life difficult for those who are making your life difficult, mm-hmm. and make life easy for you, who we know are trying to strive for a better, more free, more law-abiding Iran.
Right. If the Trump administration went to the European countries and said, okay, let's together figure out how to squeeze Iran, how to push this along, A, will he get any cooperation? B, if he did get cooperation out of us, what common ground is there?
I think initially when President Trump said that this is a bad deal, mm-hmm. although he, in his hyperbole, said this is the worst deal in history, but he said this is a very bad deal. Unless you fix it, we're going to walk. The Europeans clearly were trying to make Iran make some concessions.
Right.
And I think if Iran had seen that Europe, United States, Russia, and China, they were less likely to join this. But the Europeans, I think, were trying to make a concession. They might have made some concessions out of Iran, particularly mm-hmm. on the missile issue, for example.
Right.
And other issues. I think that might have been the common ground mm-hmm. that Europe has. But I think you know this as much better than I do, that I think there is a growing rift between Europe and the United States. And this recent trip by President Trump clearly showed that.
You saw it with what Mr. Macron said, where he not only said what he said, but he did it at a very solemn occasion right in front of the President of the United States.
Right in front of the President.
That is as close to slapping another world leader as you can get.
Absolutely. And, you know, to me, that is a major mm-hmm. change. And the Europeans, instead of trying to now find common ground with the United States, are trying to see whether they can find a common ground maybe with China and mm-hmm. Russia and India and Turkey to circumvent these sanctions. And, you know, to be, I think, truthful to history, in the past, the Europeans have not been very good at standing up to this regime. Mm-hmm. This regime has killed more than 120 opponents in Europe. Mm-hmm. More than once, the embassy has been clearly complicit in these assassinations.
Right.
And the Europeans have made a deal behind the closed door, allowed the murderers to go back to Iran to a hero's welcome. So there is room for some skepticism,
right.
But I think they were trying to make the deal work. I still think they're trying to make a deal work. Before, they were trying to make it work with the U.S. Now, mm-hmm. in the absence of U.S.
Let's go back to the 1970s and the dying days of the Peacock Throne. And I understand that there was a very charismatic gentleman sitting in France at the time, the Ayatollah. But what internally drove the revolution? Was there a flashpoint? Was there an event? What actually triggered things? Because as we look at Iran right now, that is the question. We saw protests in December, January of last year, and we thought, okay, this might be it or not, but it didn't quite take, if you would. It was sort of like trying to light a wet log. It just didn't quite catch on fire. So if you look back 40 years ago and versus today, are there any parallels between then and now in terms of what could spark a revolution in this day and age?
You know, I don't think there was one spark. Mm-hmm. I think it was a process. It was an accumulation of several things that were happening together, and they created a perfect storm.
Right.
In the book I wrote about the Shah, called The Shah, mm-hmm. I actually called the revolution a perfect storm. It's something very rare that happened. Everything lined up.
What was the storm?
One, the Iranian economy that was going at 20% increased GMP a year mm-hmm. suddenly had to slow down.
Okay.
It had to slow down seriously. Iran that gave away $1 billion next year had to go borrow money. Mm-hmm. Iran that had been an authoritarian regime under Jimmy Carter's pressure began to open up. And you know, and anyone who's read Aristotle knows, the four authoritarian regimes, the most dangerous time is mm-hmm. when you begin to open up.
Right.
add to that the fact that the Shah had cancer and was taking medications and made him more indecisive. Add to that the fact that the U.S. was caught in a remarkable variations of policy between the State Department led by Vance, Brzezinski in the White House, and Sullivan in Iran, writing his own foreign policy.
Right.
And in that mix, there was a leader sitting in Najaf who had not a slightest possibility of becoming the leader of Iran, suddenly sees the regime in crisis and begins to become even more active. And as the U.S. decides to that the Shah can't really stay by late 1978, they begin to try to find an alternative that will hold the country together and stop the communists from spreading. And who do they decide? And all of this is in the archives, you could see it.
Right.
The religious forces. They think Islam is a force that can stop the communists, hold the country together. And this hadn't been just the mistake the United States made. This was really the strategy the Shah had.
Right.
In order to fight the communists, which the Shah saw as his main threat, in order to fight the nationalists, the Mossadegh supporters, the Shah thought, not wrongly, everybody else thought the same thing, that the antidote to them would be the Islamists.
Right.
The U.S. made that same calculation when they support when Ronald Reagan supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan.
Right.
They all missed one important point. These guys have a claim to power.
Right.
They want to recreate the caliphate, or the closest thing to the caliphate. And as soon as they could, they did.
Right. It's a bit like embracing Hitler in the middle of the 1930s, thinking, what a swell fella. He's building roads in Germany. Germany is active. And nobody's going back and reading Mein Kampf and seeing what actually his goal is in life. Let's do a side-by-side quickly of 1978, 1979 versus 2018 in the ways you just described. So first of all, the economy. Worse today than then?
The economy clearly is worse today than it was in 78. The Iranian economy was not in a crisis in 1978. It was a very healthy economy. But these guys, once they came over, took power, they decimated the Iranian private sector, for example.
Right.
Iranian had a very vibrant private sector that was competing very effectively in the region. The Iranian automotive industry, was competing with South Korea in 1975. Look at where South Korea is. Look at where Iran is.
Right.
That's the cost of this revolution. So Iran had virtual full employment in 77. We can't talk about 78 because by then the country was in crisis.
Right.
You look at 77, you had a full employment. Iran was bringing in workers, engineers from Korea, from Philippines, from India. Iran had $24 billion surplus in its assets in Park Chase Manhattan Bank. It had a thriving middle class. Now you have every company that was making money at the time is now virtually bankrupt. Or bankrupt, completely bankrupt. You have double-digit unemployment and double-digit inflation, and you've had them almost for 38 years. It's unheard of for a country to survive all of this. You have a falling share of the oil market. You have very little prospect of going back to what Iran was in 75, producing 6 million barrels of oil. These guys have never surpassed 4 million. It's now at 22.5 million. It's probably going to be 1.5 million then. And you had the goodwill of the international community that wanted Iran to grow and wanted to invest in Iran. You had an inverse of brain drain. Iranians who were in the United States, Europe, doctors, wanted to go back to Iran. Now everything has been reversed. So the economy is far worse. The level of opposition is far worse.
Okay. So that's okay. So point number one, economy versus economy. Point number two would be leadership versus leadership. 1978, you have a Shaw, a cancer-stricken Shaw. In 2018, you have this current theocracy, not stricken with cancer physically, but couldn't you argue there is a cancer just in terms of repression?
Well, first of all, the leader does have cancer, actually.
Okay. He does have cancer.
Khamenei has cancer.
All right.
Has had cancer for a while. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems in Iran is that everybody thinks he's about to die and nobody knows what's going to succeed him. But there was one very big difference between that leadership and this leadership. Mm-hmm. This leadership has made it very clear, and not metaphorically, literally, mm-hmm. to the Iranian people that if you challenge us, we're going to turn Iran into another Syria. We're not going to give up. The Shah, as soon as he realized that the West is now no longer fully behind him, mm-hmm. as soon as he realized that people don't seem to want him, he decided to leave the country.
Fled him, right.
The Shah could have used the military and created bloodshed and maybe could have stayed longer. But he had decency to say, I can't govern this place. I don't want to destroy it. Half pouting, half angry, half disappointed, mm-hmm. half patriotically. There are lots of halves, but all of these things contributed. He decided to leave. This regime is not going to do that.
Okay, so point number one, economy worse now than back then. Point number two, it sounds like they're suggesting political leadership, the current leadership, in a stronger position than the Shah, at least in the regards of telling the public that, you know, if we leave, bad things are going to happen.
I wouldn't use the word stronger position, but I would say more determined position.
More determined, so more dogged.
Okay. More dogged and more willing to use violence to stay in power.
Okay, point number three, Abbas. The Shah's willingness to let a little sunshine in the country, give people a taste of the West. What about this regime?
This regime has essentially tried to do the opposite. It says the sunshine of the West was a plague. We should
no rock and roll, no blue jeans, no decadence. No
That's what the regime has tried.
Right.
But I don't think the Iranian society has ever been as westernized in fashion, mm-hmm. in what they watch, in what they like, in where they like to go to school, where mm-hmm. they send their children to go right. to school, than today. So the effort for this regime mm-hmm. at remaking Iranian society.
Right.
You know, one of the characteristics of totalitarian and pseudo-totalitarian societies is that for them, politics, in the words of a great political philosophy teacher I had at Berkeley, Sheldon Volan, he says, totalitarians see politics as soul craft. Democracies see politics as a state craft. Khomeini famously said, we haven't made a revolution to decrease the price of oil. Mm-hmm. Economies for donkeys, he famously said. We have created this revolution to make an Islamic new Iran. Iran has never been less Islamic than it is today. So in their main project, they have absolutely, utterly failed.
All right. Now, the fourth and final point, and that is the United States handling of the situation. So compare the two, 40 years ago versus today. Well, Based on the Carter experience, now looking at Trump's, do you have more or less faith in the Trump administration?
No, I think both of them are mishandling the situation.
Both are missing it. So how is the Trump administration missing this?
They're missing this in a sense that, first of all, I thought walking away from the nuclear deal in mm-hmm. the way they did it was mm-hmm. a mistake.
Right.
It sort of fed into the hands of what this regime radical elements of this regime will do. You know, forming policy on Iran today, in my view, is similar to forming U.S. policy on Soviet Union in 1987. If you weren't aware that that regime is corrupt from the core and is about to collapse, you would have made different decisions. I don't think the Trump administration fully understands how to use this corrupt reality. They know it is corrupt. Mm-hmm. That's the gamble that you refer to.
Right.
Their gamble is, this is so hard that we're going to push it to the tilt. That wasn't what the Reagan administration decided to do with Soviet Union. They knew that it was corrupt and about to collapse. Mm-hmm. They said, you want the tunnel? Okay, We'll do the talk. We'll talk to you. But we also want to talk about human rights.
Right.
Imagine if in 1987, Ronald Reagan had said, no negotiations with Iran. We're going to walk away from SALT I, SALT II, all the agreements we've had, because these are less than perfect agreements. History would not have judged Ronald Reagan the way it is now judging it.
Correct. Correct. Final question, Abbas. You're a serious man. You did not bring a crystal ball today. You're a serious man. You're a very serious academic. You probably don't like to make predictions, but let's have this conversation before the next 11 months. But what does your sense tell you as to where we're headed right now? These sanctions are in place. Hard to see Trump letting go of the sanctions unless the Iranians give something very big, which would be what? Getting out of Syria, getting out of the terrorism business, or what? Getting rid of its nuclear ambitions. Hard to see them budging on those. So where are we headed?
I think the most likely scenario is that the regime will try to repivot towards Russia and China more. It will try to draw a further wedge between Europe and the United States, between Europe and United States and Turkey. It will use Turkey, China, India, Russia to eke out an existence. It will not collapse under, in my view, under the pressure of these. The Iranian people will be the ones who suffer the most. The IRGC, which is the source of much of the trouble, will get richer because they have gotten richer in illicit trade, in bringing in contraband commodities to Iran. They're the biggest smugglers in Iran. Everybody knows that.
Right. So is there anything positive to say about this situation?
The Iranian people and their willingness, particularly women, to fight this regime tooth and nail and not give up the very difficult struggle to make democracy in Iran without destroying the country. I am, if we want to add on a happy note, we are right that we don't make predictions. But 20 years from now, if there is one country that I have very great hope that will be a more democratic society where women will have more equal role in the Muslim Middle East, I would put my bet on Iran.
Good. Well, let's have you back on the podcast soon, and hopefully we'll have some better things to talk about.
I hope so.
Abbas Milani, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Area 45, a Hoover Institution podcast on the policy avenues available to the 45th President of the United States. If you've been enjoying Area 45, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. And if you wouldn't mind, please spread the word. Get your friends to have a listen. The Hoover Institution is online at www.hoover.org. And while you're there, do yourself a favor and sign up for the Hoover Daily Report, which delivers the best work of Abbas Milani and his Hoover colleagues to your inbox weekdays. The Hoover Institution has Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter feeds. Our Twitter handle is at Hoover Inst. That's at Hoover INST. Abbas Milani is on Twitter. His Twitter handle is at Milani Abbas. His name spelled backwards. And you spell that MILANIABBAS. Did I get that right, Milani? Thank you. You'll find, by the way, if you go on the Stanford website, stanford.edu, you'll find an entire page devoted to Dr. Milani on his research and writing. I encourage you to go read that. For the Hoover Institution, this is Bill Whalen. We'll be back soon with another installment of Area 45. Until then, take care. And as always, thanks for listening.
For more podcasts from the Hoover Institution, please visit hoover.org or Hoover's channels on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Podbean, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Spotify. I'm Chris Dauer for the Hoover Institution. Thanks for listening.